This is a FUBAR Radio podcast. Go to FUBARradio.com for more details. Screen Talk with Dan Clark on FUBAR Radio.
Hello and welcome to another edition of Screen Talk. I'm Dan Clark. Now, today we have a brilliant, wonderful show. I was lucky enough to interview Mark Gatiss, the man behind, one of the men behind The League of Gentlemen, Sherlock, Doctor Who, amongst the many, many things that he does. I ask him about how he fits in being an actor, writer, playwright, radio writer, TV writer, a comedian, all these things. It's such a great conversation. That's coming up in a minute. I do just want to remind you, if you listen to this show and you enjoy the show, please rate it, because I don't understand the algorithm behind it, but for some reason it helps get the show out there to more people. So please rate it. If you didn't enjoy the show, don't rate it and stop listening now. But pass the word on. So before we get to the Mark Gatiss interview, which I recorded yesterday, I have with me, it's been almost a month, a whole month, I think. Ladies and gentlemen, give a massive round of applause, as though we're in a comedy club, for Mr. James Gill. Hello, James.
Smooth. How are you, mate? Mate, so good to see you again.
Yeah, you too.
Just listeners, just so you know, when Dan and I haven't seen each other for a few weeks, and as he walked in, I hugged him and he was going for a handshake.
Well, come on. That's just painted me out to be some kind of, like, emotionless, repressed guy.
I'm so sorry. You know. I said that thinking, oh, Dan's going to laugh at this. He looked quite hurt when I said that.
I feel hurt.
I'm really sorry.
You know, I just what I tend to do with that sort of thing, and we haven't got time to really talk about, like,
hugging etiquette.
Yeah, but I tend to do the hand first and then go in for the hug. So it's like a two-beat manoeuvre, you know?
Have you ever hugged someone who's not a hugger, they're a handshaker?
I think I have done that.
It's terrible.
So tell us, James, tell us what is new out there, what is news, what is doom and gloom, I think, is what you're about to...
This is such a huge topic. I mean, this is essentially everything that we cover. So there's some news come out that... a lot of it is legal speak, but so we'll just boil it down. So there's a film coming out next year called Monster Trucks, and it's a Paramount movie. And in finance speak, Paramount have essentially said to their financial people, perhaps this film isn't going to make as much as we thought it might. They were thinking it was going to be an enormous smash. And
they've made this public information.
Yes. Yeah. But we obviously need to be careful, because obviously it could still end up... we can't predict the future. This is what's so unusual. This film doesn't come out until next year.
Yeah.
So sometimes a studio will say such a thing once a film has come out. So let's say if it has a disappointing opening weekend, they can say, we thought it was going to make X. It turns out it's going to make Y. But for them to say this... I mean, it is incredible. For them to say this months before the film comes out is an odd one. And so, dear listener, it got Dan and I talking. Because what it all boils down to is the future of cinema. You may think that's a bold claim, but...
Well, we've talked about this. We've touched upon this before. About, like, you know, the way that the cinema's going and the TV audience is sort of taking the cinema audiences away with their sort of...
Amazing TV show
and class dramas and stuff.
So TV at the moment are able to take risks that movies are perhaps not. So 2016 will probably be remembered as the year that movies struggled, especially in the summer, to the extent where experts believe that there's no such thing as this blockbuster summer season anymore. I mean, I have a list of films that have...
It's a bit extreme, I think, but...
I mean, I actually don't think it is, because this summer, here we go. Here are a few films that have... I'm not saying that all of these flopped, but a lot of them certainly underperformed. Mm-hmm. So The Legend of Tarzan, I mean, that did not do well. X-Men Apocalypse, slightly disappointed at the box office. Ben-Hur, I mean, that was a proper flop.
A turkey, they used to call them.
Yes. Independence Day Resurgence, which was such a shame, because I really loved that film, but that didn't do so well. Ghostbusters, again, perhaps didn't quite do as well as it might have done. The second Turtles movie is another one. Alice Through the Looking Glass. Allegiant, which was the third movie as part of the Divergent series, which again was supposed to be a huge franchise. The BFG, Pete's Dragon, which was a lovely film. And then McConaughey in what we thought may have been an Oscar contender, Free State of Jones. Now, I'm a positive guy. There is no dressing up the fact that that is a heck of a lot of films that have all not done quite as well as they might.
So we know that films in the summer tend to be tentpoles, blockbusters, and generally across the board in movies, you need spectacle, you need pre-existing IP, you need all these things.
It's fascinating
to
get
people into the cinema. But maybe what's happening now, this isn't me being positive.
Yeah.
But maybe what's happening.
Let's try to be positive.
I mean, maybe what's happening is people are getting tired of all those films, except for the last one, are movies that were part of franchises, are remakes, are reboots.
Based on something.
And maybe, you know, obviously Suicide Squad and Batman v Superman, both films that were critically annihilated but did really well, prove that people still want superhero films, much to my annoyance. But maybe there is a glass ceiling with this stuff. Now, the problem is, I think, as you said to me, describe how you put the conundrum of, you know, why would you...
Right, so the conundrum is this. If you pay X pounds a month for, say, Sky, are you going to watch the box set of The Night Of, which is amazing,
the new drama from HBO, everyone's talking about,
or are you and your wife, husband, partner, date, are you going to spend upwards of 30-40 pounds?
That's a lot of lovers you've got.
Well,
that's, your wife,
that's just
your partner,
a standard Tuesday. what a night that would be.
A bit awkward in the cinema.
That's a lot of popcorn. Or would you spend 30, 40 pounds going to the cinema to see a film that might not be amazing? And what this all comes down to is the future of cinema is at stake, really.
Yeah, which I think is a shame, because even though I love the way that TV has gone for the last 10 years and continues to go, and the fact that that Westworld trailer, I don't know if you've seen that.
It's mind-blowing.
10 years ago, you would never believe that a TV show could do something like that.
That's right.
And it's amazing that you can let characters breathe and explore different story avenues. I like that. I'm not against that. But the problem I have is I still like going to the cinema. I still like closed-ended stories. I like a 90-minute thriller or a drama or a comedy, good comedy. And I still want to go to the cinema where I haven't got all the distractions of my home life.
Yes.
And watch something with amazing sound system and, you know, a big screen. I still want that experience. It's just that no one's going to put money into the types of films I like.
That's right.
Into cinema.
I mean, you and I, we both love going to the cinema. You can't beat it. It's a wonderful experience. It takes you back to your childhood. There's something wonderful about just you and the movie. There's no checking your phone. There's no chatting. It's glorious. So maybe it's a simple case of there are just too many movies.
And also, you know, how do you put spectacle? Because if they're saying the reason that people would go to the cinema versus watch TV is because of the production value and stuff, but then maybe we need to think about, I say we,
no,
you and
true.
Me,
yeah.
Think about how you put spectacle in a film that doesn't feel obvious. Because sadly, a lot of those films, it's not that they're not good, some of those are good films, but it's just, well, they're thinking people will only go and see a film like Independence Day because they already know the title. But maybe the problem is, well, I kind of know that film. I mean, how's it going to be that different to the first film, you know?
I mean, for me, if I was going to pick one film out on that list that's the head-scratcher, I would have said Independence Day Resurgence. Yeah. And I'm sure Fox think the same, because it was a really good movie. It was thoroughly enjoyable. Was it silly? Of course it was. But also, the PR machine was cranked up to full effect. They did a tour of the planet with the talent. Mm-hmm. They started in Australia. They worked their way around the globe. They worked hard to push that movie. And the fact that it didn't do so well is a real head scratcher, a fascinating head scratcher. So recently, one of the producers of the new Blair Witch movie did a multi-tweet, and his point was that he's produced a lot of indie films, a lot of them are good indie movies, and a lot of them had done okay at the box office, but not got much in the way of attention. And he said that Blair Witch is the first film he's ever been associated with that people have actually pretty much given a damn before it's come out. And his point is that you sort of have to... All right, I know this list would contradict what he's saying, but he says that there is a reason why people make franchise movies, spin-off sequels, reboots, etc. And it's because it's something that the public identify with. So it's even trickier to make a totally original movie and still make it a success at the box office.
I completely get that. I get that, you know, in a world where there's so much volume, so much noise, so many options, that sometimes when you're trying to make a decision, you want to go with something that you feel like you already
understand.
Oh, I know
this world.
Okay, yeah, I get it. But at some point, maybe that's going to have a... like, it's going to come back to bite you at some point, because, you know... Neighbours was not popular, isn't as popular as it used to be.
Sure.
So, terrible example.
No, no,
but, you know, like, everything dwindles at some point. You know, people can't stay as absolutely fascinated and in love with the Star Wars. Well, maybe Star Wars is one.
But that's interesting.
You know, you can't be as obsessed with it after. It's like, okay, we both once talked about our love of the band Pearl Jam. One of the reasons I like them so much is because they completely disappeared from the spotlight. They didn't have a website. They didn't have, like, they didn't do videos and interviews. And it made me more obsessed about them, because I was like, I want to know who these people are. They're not on Twitter. They're not doing all this constant. The more you know about someone, at some point, I'm not saying it's going to happen straight away, but at some point, people are going, yeah, you know, that's like, it's like they're in my living room. What's so.
I agree.
What's so kind of like fascinating about that?
Because at the moment, the films that are still doing great business are the ones that are, say, a Marvel superhero movie or a Star Wars movie, but they're still brilliant movies. So, for example, Captain America: Civil War was an absolute cracker. So it had that winning combination of being utterly brilliant, being awesome on the big screen, and being part of this. I mean, Marvel, let's be honest, have absolutely nailed it.
I mean, and what I'll give them credit for, because, you know, as you know, I'm not like as a bigger fan of the comic book world as you are. But what I give them credit for is they're always looking for, like, who could be the new interesting director who could give this
a slightly new
that's absolutely twist.
True.
They've gone for, like, with the Deadpool thing, they went for a, like, R-rated comedy.
Yeah.
You know, they're sort of mixing it up a bit within the brand. So maybe that's why they're still smashing it so much. I've never said the phrase smashing it, by the way.
I liked it. It fit like a glove. God. But I imagine Hollywood will be asking itself some big questions. Not only the bigger studios, but I mean, some of the... I mean, what's tough out there is for the smaller independent studios, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. But you know what? Like, there was the phrase straight to DVD is now no longer a dirty word.
No.
Because films get released and a home release at the same time.
So one film we talked about was Born to be Blue, the Chet Baker biopic.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
That, you know, that was a really good movie. Ethan Hawke is wonderful in it. However, you could, if you wanted to see that
see
on home,
you
could.
And I think, you know, even though I would much rather the middle ground $30-40 million movies to be made again, and hopefully one day maybe that will happen, but probably not. I still think there is an upside to the indie world, which is there are more places for people to see indies rather than short little life at the cinema, and then, you know, no one ever hears of it again. The video on demand maybe gives it a second life or more chance.
I mean, one thing we were perhaps going to talk about was Curtis Hanson.
Of course, yes. Curtis Hanson, who sadly passed this week. I don't know how you feel about Curtis Hanson. I'm a big fan of his...
I mean, LA Confidential.
Yeah.
I mean, regular listeners will be saying, James, your top 10 list has 300 films in it. LA Confidential would be in my top 10.
In your top 300.
In my top 300. But I think it's an absolute...
Yeah,
I think it's an absolute... masterpiece.
I've never said belter either before.
Mate, smash it, belter. I love it. It's the new presenter, Dapper Lass. It's just a wonderful film. I love Russell Crowe. I think it might be the best thing he's ever done.
It's such a note-perfect movie, so it's brilliant. He's also done, like, Wonder Boys is one of my favourite films, completely underrated. Douglas is stunning in it. And he also did this film, which I really like, which... you know, I didn't think it was going to be aimed at me. I thought it might be a chick flick, and I mean that in the negative sense of the word, not like films about women. Was the film In Her Shoes? I don't know.
Never
if you've seen
it.
It's a really
Toni
good
Collette.
Film. Toni Collette, who's one of my favourite actresses, and Cameron Diaz, who is also brilliant in it as well. But a really clever, smart comedy drama that is really unsurprising. Like, if you imagine, like, a film where you go, Toni Collette and Cameron Diaz are playing sisters in a sort of comedy drama, you'd think, oh, okay, that's going to be this film. But think, it's directed by Curtis Hanson.
Yeah.
So if you haven't seen it, see it. It's a really, really beautiful film. And yeah, it's a shame he didn't get to make. I always thought he would be put in that category we had Rob Reiner in, that he wouldn't be considered an auteur because he kind of does so many different genres and things. But I think, you know, if you've got three or four not classics, but certainly brilliant five-star movies in your canon.
I think the sad thing, he was not a well guy, was he, for the last few years?
I think he had to pull out something.
Such a shame, and it just made me want to rewatch LA Confidential.
Let's do it.
Yeah, let's absolutely
put it on somewhere.
You and I watch it. We do a live tweet. Everyone has to press play at the same time.
Okay,
is this a terrible idea? it's just gonna be me and you.
Or we'll do a podcast of us watching it, where obviously because of the time constraints, it'll end 2/3 of the way into the film. Well, look, thanks, James. Thanks for coming on. I hope to see you much sooner. Let's make the gap not as long next time.
I'll just very quickly say, a film out next week that is not a superhero movie or a spin-off.
You always do this to me, by the way. I wrap things up.
I'm so sorry, but this is a positive cherry on the top. So please see Deepwater Horizon. It's out next week. Mark Wahlberg
is... I'm looking forward to this.
I got to speak with Mark Wahlberg, one of the best interviews I'll ever have in my life. He was awesome. He was hilarious. Check that out. Not just because Mark was very funny, but I was blown away.
Good action.
I think it's an absolute cracker.
Oh, good.
In fact, Dan, I think it's a belter that they've smashed it.
And they've smashed it. Well, you know, we should end it there, though, because that's a perfect little roundup to today's news and review section. I'm going to play a song before I play out my Mark Gatiss interview. Stick around for that. It's a belter. There you go. Oh, God, who have I become? Anyway, in tribute to Curtis Hanson, this is a song from the film Wonder Boys. If you've never seen Wonder Boys, check it out. It's such a great film. Didn't really get the attention it deserved. This is from that film by one of my favourite all-time singer-songwriters. This is Neil Young with Old Man. Mate.
Tell that's true.
FUBAR Radio presents
Back Row and Chill with Noel Clark and Johanna James.
Blair Witch 2.
In the group of people that go through it, they're black people.
Yes.
This film's not real. Black people don't be sneaking into the woods.
I'm telling you, I'm gone. If I hit... Are you
not... How many black people die in Mount Everest? None. Because we're climbing up fucking mountains in the cold. How many black people get eaten by sharks? None. They've taken diverse casting too far, bruv, because black people are not sneaking in the woods looking for witches.
Does that said black person die?
Probably die first.
And they die first, we're back on track. It's normal.
Yeah,
it's normal.
Yeah. It's like I can buy that they went into the woods because they died first. Yeah.
Every Friday.
Back Row and Chill with Noel Clark and Johanna James.
From 4 p.m. on FUBAR Radio. Screen Talk with Dan Clark on FUBAR Radio.
Hello, Mark.
Hi, Dan.
Thanks for joining us. Is this how you speak and look now? So Mark currently is sitting with me wearing his sunglasses.
It's because it's very sunny, isn't
it? It's very sunny, yeah. And it's not
Let's
at all.
Go in now.
It's not at all because you've just won an Emmy and you now obliged to look American.
It's the way it goes, isn't it?
It is,
some
yeah.
Sort of course you have to go
this
on.
Is this your first Emmy?
It is.
Yeah, oh, congratulations.
Sherlock has won a lot. I haven't had my own, so everybody else seemed to win one last time.
Yeah. Oh, wow, but unfortunately you couldn't be there.
Couldn't go, because I'm rehearsing the boys in the
yeah.
band, yes.
Which, so for people that are listening and thinking, what's with all the noise in the background, I was going to say joined by Mark, but actually in a way I'm joining you.
Very much
in your symbiotic
way.
Yeah. So why don't you tell us a bit about what you're doing at the moment? You're in this...
Well, we're at Park Theatre in Finsbury yeah. Park, where we're doing... Daniel Boys just crossing by. We're doing a revival of a famous American play called The Boys in the Band, which was this sort of the seminal gay play. It's the mm-hmm. first actual play with gay men in it, as opposed to sort of coded versions or in a sort of Tennessee Williams way.
Okay.
It's an extraordinary piece of work. It hasn't been done here for 20 years. And it's
where was it on when it was first put on?
Here. Last time,
yeah,
it was on in the West End at the Albury, I think.
Okay,
started at the King's Head actually, and then transferred. But the original New York production was a sensation, and you know, it changed the landscape. It was mm-hmm. just like everything. It was about 18 months before the Stonewall riots. Everything sort of it was one of those moments,
yeah.
you know. But it's really interesting. It's always been very controversial because it's. It's essentially, someone said to me, what's it about? I said, it's about 9 self-loathing gay men in a New York apartment, 1968. And then they said, why do you want to do it? I said, it's because it's about 9 self-loathing gay men. it's a very particular snapshot of a time. But equally, I think what's really exciting about doing it now is to see how far we've come
yeah.
or how far we haven't. And actually, an awful lot of its themes seem to me to resonate
So it's still set
yeah,
in 68.
It's very much
You're
set
not,
in
like,
68.
Updating
no.
it, yeah.
But it's actual, it's very, very funny, very catty, nasty play.
Yeah.
But its actual themes are very relevant, I think, very powerful.
And you're doing this with your husband?
Yes.
Is that a wise move?
Well, yeah, everyone's asking us. He said the other day we were on Graham Norton's show, and he said, we do actually like each other.
Yeah.
But obviously, I suppose it's the work thing, isn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, yeah.
We've done a bit of TV together and a bit of radio. But this first time on stage, it's going fine so far.
Good. You've presumably been rehearsing a lot.
Yeah, although yeah. I don't actually come into it till the end of Act One, so okay. I've got quite a long... It's a big build-up
yeah.
at the Iceman Cometh.
See, my girlfriend for a very long time was like, we should work together, and I just had it in my head that it would be disastrous.
It
and
may
it,
be, who knows?
But, well, we did it yeah. recently in the summer, and it was brilliant.
There you are.
You have a shorthand that you don't really have.
I mean, yes. And I'll tell you, you know, one of the biggest things about if your other half is rehearsing a play, it is beholden upon you to run lines with them.
Mm-hmm.
And it is, of course, one of the most thankless things. Don't tell me.
Yeah.
And then you squeeze it out and then you get cross with each other.
Yeah.
But if you're both doing it, it's fantastic.
Yeah, that's
because
a really
actually
good point.
You're, you know, you're doing stuff in the same. Then you sort of need to bring a third party in to help you with the other lines, and then you can get cross with them.
Yeah, because I've helped my girlfriend read her lines for auditions and things, and it's like the worst thing in the world. She finds all direction like a criticism, or yes. it just her fuse is so short when yeah. we. But then when we worked together and I directed her in something I'd written, it was wonderful.
That's really good. Yeah. No, the shorthand is a vital thing, really. Yeah. I think, and you know, we always had that in the League of Gentlemen. A kind of we finish each other's sentences, and we used to have this thing all the time where. Because every single interview we've ever done, someone will say, how did you come up with it? And we used to have this shorthand thing. We sort of look around each other and one or other of us would just go. And then they'd volunteer to tell the story. It was like, it's your turn.
Yeah. Well, also, you do tell these things over and over again over the years.
Do you find I refine them like a joke?
Do you?
And you end up thinking, I'm boring myself. I think I've heard myself say this so many times, but I have now got it down into a kind of haiku of, here is the very basic version of...
Yeah. You know. Well, I think sometimes you should just have a little... like a card or something and with ready-made answers.
Or start lying.
Yeah.
And like people do.
Create a whole new backstory.
Michael Gambon got so bored years ago doing interviews, he started to say that he had once been gay but had changed his mind
just completely,
and it went on and eventually someone said, what happened, what changed his mind? He said, it made my eyes water.
Oh, that's amazing. It's a shame that we have to say the same things over and over. But
am I lying to you throughout this interview?
Well, I think...
Maybe I already am.
Is this... That Emmy's not real, is it? I'm worried that this is the closest I'll ever get. No. I love that you brought a BBC Worldwide bag.
I must explain. The Emmy is here, not because I've been carried around with me, but because I went in Steve Moffin's Sue Virtue, went out to LA... And I went into the Sherlock edit this morning, and so they brought me the Emmy. So that's why I've had to bring it to rehearsals. I'm not carrying it around like a pack animal.
No, of course not. I mean, that would be such commitment to your ego, because it's so heavy. Did you stay up and watch, or did you just wake up to?
Well,
really
it's not
good
on
news?
Live, is it? I don't think it isn't.
I
turned my phone off.
So you're doing this play, and I've noticed over the years you do plays regularly, right?
Mm.
And yet you write so much stuff as well, and you act on screen. How do you do this? How do you fit this in? Because it's not like a play, something you can just phone in. You commit to months.
Wait.
Well, if you want to see Mark Gatiss phone in a performance, come along to the Wild Theatre.
When it works, when a year works well, the balance is really fine. You know, I was writing Sherlock half of last year, filming Sherlock April to August, and now I'm doing a play. So, and in between I've been writing bits and pieces. So if it works like that, it's okay.
Yeah.
I have to tell you, you ask at a very sensitive time, because I am currently, I have collided with a horrific deadline at the worst possible time. So sometimes the answer is not very well is the answer.
Is this valuable writing time right now then?
No, it's fine, because I've got to come in for rehearsals anyway. But no, sometimes it works fine. Other times it's a bit of a car crash.
Are you good? Are you good at? I can only presume you must be, because you are because you do so much work. But are you good at that kind of spinning plates? Because I find I need one thing at a time.
To be honest, I am good at it, but I also, when it very occasionally happens that I'm just completely focused on one thing, I really enjoy it.
Yeah.
And I always think I should do this more often. In fact, I know I should. I've turned down a couple of things from next year, beginning of next year, but really to just give myself exactly that, give myself focus on the thing I'm doing. Right. So, but I can't, I'm good. I write best early in the morning, and I can get up very early and kind of carve out that marvellous time before anyone's around.
How early is early?
Maybe 5 or 6.
Are you serious?
Yeah, not all the time, but I can do it. And if I'm in the mood, there's nothing better, because the concentration is so good. And then, you know, no one starts phoning up or anything before 9 or 10. So you can get a lot. The trouble is, I always forget, and you get a kind of amnesia about it that... And then you think, this is amazing. And then you realise at like 2:45 that you want to die. 2:45 in the afternoon.
Because it's
and then
like
you go to bed.
8 at night for you, isn't it? Yeah.
So you can't really do it both ends.
Do you have a trick or anything? I find writing in the morning for me is like there's stuff, layers of other things I need to get through. I tried doing the artist's way thing where you write the morning pages. Have you heard about that?
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
But that just ends up becoming a kind of a purge of...
I don't think that... I mean, everyone has a method, don't they?
Yeah.
But it's all haphazard, I think. I that's all I can say. I know that I definitely am better in the mornings. I feel fresher. I feel clearer. I always have to start from the beginning. I have to reread it. I can't just plunge in.
Yeah.
But if I can get in a zone, and I can write for ages, and I think that's my... Rather than doing like 2 or 3 hours every single day or something, if I can really... You know, it is like play. Or you can sort of imagine... You can see the whole script in your head, and you can kind of... You think, oh, right. But anything that breaks that, you're kind of out of it.
Yeah. So then that would make me think you would, doing the kind of multitasking would get in the way of that.
I couldn't, there's no point in me coming here with my laptop and trying to do 45 minutes between rehearsals.
No.
But if I have like a whole morning, like today, before I come in, I can do it like that. And sometimes when I'm filming, if this sounds ridiculously Hollywood, but if you're stuck in your trailer... caravan, three-way. If you're stuck in your three-way for hours waiting to get called or with nothing to do between like one shot in the morning and another in the evening, that's like amazing. I find that brilliant that time.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, basically what do? You sit and read a book or twiddle your thumbs or eat too much cooking.
Well, you've got a whole other job that other actors don't have.
But
that
it's
you
also
can...
kind of, what's interesting is it's a kind of prescribed piece of time.
Yeah.
You know, you know your hours are, it's like a kind of structure.
Yeah.
Which if I was just sitting at home with all day, I might not sort of respond to.
So sometimes you go, God, I hope they only use me in the morning and the afternoon. Whereas other actors are like, oh, I've got nothing to do. Yeah. Oh, that's interesting. I think that I've got better as I've got older at being able to go, okay, I've got 2 hours here, whereas I used to be, maybe it's just mortality. You're like, I can't wait forever for the muse to come. Do you know what I mean?
No, but it is,
I'll be dead soon.
It's ridiculous, isn't it? You just think, when it's flowing, you think, oh, this is, why isn't it always like that? Because that's why it isn't always like that.
Do you, why do you do, like on a personal level, why do you do so many things? Is it just... You
mania.
Loved mania, avoidance.
I was genuinely a very lazy child, and I think I have a. I could be very lazy, and maybe it's a way of not being lazy.
Making up for lost years.
I am a thing, but also, you know, I'm very aware there are only so many projects you can do in your short time on earth.
Yeah,
and also, there's lots of things I'm very passionate about, and also. People ask me to do things that you know. I remember Stephen Fry saying when he and Hugh Laurie were offered Jeeves and Wooster, and they said, "Oh no, we can't." And then they realised they were going to ask somebody else, and they went, "No, we'll have to do it." And sometimes there's a bit of that.
You're like, "Oh, I can't be the person that didn't get to do that."
Or, you know. But mostly I try and go by gut instinct and stuff that I. I'm passionate about.
Yeah. What's the difference between do you find working on stuff that you create that's genuinely like created from the ground up like League or original compared to stuff that existed before like Doctor Who or Sherlock or
it depends. I mean the thing is with Sherlock particularly it's mine and Stephen's vision. It's our version of it. So,
and
even
you often get credited as the creators of Sherlock.
Yeah,
which is kind of interesting.
Well, we're the creators of Sherlock, not of Sherlock Holmes.
Yeah.
But there was some precedent before.
Yeah.
But although we do sort of we go back to the stories to a greater or lesser extent for every series. As a concept, we are completely honouring. I mean, that was the point of it. Yeah. That is the point of it, was to go back to Conan Doyle and say, it doesn't have to be all about the hansom cabs and everything. It's about these two unlikely friends.
Yeah.
It's a flat share concept. And he was one of the greatest writers, perhaps the greatest short story writer we ever had. He was an amazing, a genius.
Mm-hmm.
So we at every stage, we said, we've completely resisted any effort to do Sherlock novelizations, because we just want people to read Conan Doyle because he's the master. Yeah. You know? So
no, like, comic book spin-offs?
Oh, no, we've done comic books, have but you? They're of our episodes. Okay. Nothing else. Yeah. No, nothing original. Nothing.
Do you think that was something that in some of the other adaptations of it got lost, the friendship thing?
Oh, definitely. I mean, yeah. we were kind of inspired by... There were sort of too many in a rush of things that just seemed to be all about the trappings, not about what it is and the reason why people liked it in the first place. So that was a sort of restoration rather than a reinvention.
And it's interesting you say that. Do you think that, I've just thought of this now, but do you think that's also partly because you both come from having made comedies, that so many comedies, especially sitcoms, are about, you know, unlikely friendships? Or
I don't know, maybe. I mean, the thing is,
a drama.
People forget how funny the original stories are. Yeah. They are funny. Sherlock Holmes is a funny man. He's not. And I think it was a reaction against that kind of austere version, which seems to be terribly humorless and kind of grave and like some sort of monument rather than what he actually is. Yeah. But I mean, it's the same argument as with Doctor Who. You know, Terry Nation, who essentially invented Doctor Who, because, you know, it starts with the Daleks, and they completely rethought what they were going to do once the Daleks took off. And of course, he was Tony Hancock's gag writer and a great comic writer, and it begins there.
Yeah.
You know, and every periodically, when people sort of turn up their nose at the notion of comedy writers writing anything serious, you think, well, first of all, it's very hard to write comedy.
Yeah.
And secondly, anyone who's actually alive knows that life is always a strange, bittersweet mixture of the two.
Yeah, yeah.
There's no such thing as drama and comedy in that way.
And I think we're living in an era where that is happening more and more with a lot of half, especially in America, the half-hour comedies feel more like something between the two.
Absolutely. And it's reflective of real life. It's also reflective of a blurring of the lines in most aspects of society, you know.
I still think the best adaptation of Sherlock Holmes is Without a Clue. Have you actually seen it? What is that?
Just leaving a sort of pregnant atmospheric pause. It's a great idea.
It is a good idea. Not amazingly necessarily executed. But having said that, I haven't seen it for like 20 years.
Nor have I. I've seen most Sherlock Holmes films.
Tried to do that
maybe
again.
Maybe I should watch it again.
Yeah.
It is a great idea, I think.
Were these all shows? They must have been shows you loved as a kid, right? And books and all the things you've been so successful in.
Yeah. I mean, I'm kind of, you know, I am still pleasing the 8-year-old version of me, which I think is
the lazy 8-year-old.
It's the way to do it. It is. Yeah. I mean, Doctor Who and Sherlock Holmes were basically my two favorite things as a child.
Yeah.
And that's what I've done.
It's so amazing. I play this game sometimes. If ever I'm feeling a bit down about things, I go, look, just go back like even 5 years in a time machine and tell yourself what you do in the next five years.
Yeah.
And you'd be like, wow, that's amazing. Yeah. But when you're ambitious and in this business where you're constantly asked, what's next? We forget to just go, oh, this is great.
Yeah,
but your 8-year-old self, if you went back, not only does he find out you actually work.
Yeah, you work.
But you work on stuff that you're a huge fan.
And also, time travel is possible.
which would be
the most thrilling thing of all, wouldn't it?
Can you imagine if that was the least thrilling thing?
What about the time travel? How did you do it?
How did you
Where's
break
it?
I'm the only person who could do it. Like Dan said, here you go and talk to your 8-year-old self. How quickly from finding out that you're working on these shows and creating them and being involved in them, does it go from joy to, holy shit, I better not fuck this up? Or does it not at all? You seem like quite a confident...
No, it's not that. It's holy shit, deadline, holy shit, so much to do.
Yeah.
Not about expectation. I mean, you know, Doctor Who, I was one of those who kept the flame alive in the dark years.
Right.
When it was off the air.
What is the dark years?
Well, it was off the air between 1989
and the Paul McGann.
And the brief Paul McGann movie, and then 2005 when it came back. But I didn't think it would come back. I just thought that was it. But I was immediately, you know, Russell's version of it was, I immediately thrilled by, because I thought it was so bold, and that is of course why it succeeded. Yeah. It wasn't a sort of Neely version. He said, "No, we're doing 45-minute episodes. We're not doing four-parters. It's got to be its own thing." Mm-hmm. The first Chris Eccleston's season doesn't have any alien planets in. It was like, let's not go to a quarry. That's what people expect. You know, right. Very clear, very clever.
It was the Alan Bleasdale,
and from Doctor the companion's Who, point of view, yeah. You know. So I mean, much more sort of bold than I would ever have been. There was just this risk, I suppose, in the sense of obviously a huge existing fan base, but also one that didn't have a show anymore.
Yeah, yeah.
That was increasingly just talking itself into a circle. And then
you could say the same about Sherlock in a way. Yeah, there wasn't like this. It had recently been on, and people were like, "We love this show." Yeah. Did it? In my memory of it, it feels like, I was talking like it was years ago, but it's like 5 years ago now.
Six years ago.
It felt like it just immediately was a hit.
It was like something from a Hollywood film from the 30s. Benedict was an overnight sensation.
Yeah.
And when we did the pre-publicity, obviously Martin was the name, and then he was an overnight sensation. That was it. It was extraordinary, and it'll never happen again to us. It was like bottled lightning. The timing, the casting, the writing, everything just clicked.
The alchemy,
And it was just its moment, you know. And it really was like that. And I remember we had a press screening, and we were anticipating people saying, "It won't work." Oh, in fact, we had one of my treasured possessions is a preview from The Independent without seeing it, which said, "You can't do Sherlock Holmes without gas lamps and top hats and hansom cabs." And he actually said, "In protest, I'm going to go home and watch one of the Basil Rathbone films." And I thought, well, you have a choice of two out of the 14, because the others are modern day, prick. But I didn't say that. But actually, after this person had seen it, they printed a complete mea culpa. Said it works, it's brilliant.
Oh well, at least they did that.
At least they did that, though.
I mean, how exciting that must have been for you guys.
It's a bit dizzying, really. Yeah. And you know, we've just made three more, so we've made 13 films in 6 years.
That's so cool.
And its reach is amazing. I mean, incredible. It uses a diplomatic weapon by the Foreign Office, I think, to try and destabilize foreign regimes.
Yeah, well, we need those. So the BBC must have been like, please do like six a series, or...
Well, in a funny way...
But they're an hour and a half, right? Yeah. So that's a lot.
Yeah, that's three films to shoot in four months is a lot of stuff. But not really, actually. Once it was a very easy commission, because Sherlock Holmes is the most filmed character in all fiction. Mm-hmm. It's Sherlock Holmes, Dracula, Tarzan, Robin Hood, I think. So it's everywhere, and it's not period, so it's cheaper.
Yeah.
So that part was easy. It was we had a few sticky moments along the way.
For the first season, unknown actor, cheap.
Yeah, cheap actors. First season. But after that, they've kind of left us alone. And I think, weirdly, the age of that thing, which used to be a very American thing. I remember the early days of the League of Gentlemen, we did some live sketches live at BBC Showcase, which was then quite a small-scale thing in Brighton, which has now become like Comic-Con itself. And I remember an American saying, can you do 38 next year? And you go, no. But I think that sort of passed away, because... The Americans and therefore all other broadcasters are asking for more bespoke things. Yeah. They're doing more six-parters and ten-parters. And
even on network television, I think they're doing it as well.
So I think that's kind of gone away. I mean, they'd always love more.
Yeah, of course.
And the gaps between seasons. But really, it's something that happened accidentally. We fell into this pattern of doing three every couple of years. But if we hadn't, we wouldn't be able to make them anymore, because Martin and Benedict would be too busy, too famous. Whereas they can actually do it every now and then.
Mm-hmm. It's funny that you just can't... I think one of the reasons it was successful is you just couldn't imagine it. As soon as it started, you were like, oh yeah, now I can't imagine a like an old Sherlock, and well, I can't imagine two other actors.
Well, we did the Christmas special, which was Victorian, as a one-off.
And then everyone's like, you can't do it. No, they did. Really.
I mean, we had virtually the same journalist said, well, how can Sherlock exist in a world without iPhones? Yeah. You go... we've done something right, but it's like there is some precedent.
Yeah, that is hilarious. So the you're in this world. By the way, you mentioned the Comic-Con thing. I mean, it's such a wonderful thing to tap into a genre or a type of TV and film that really connects with those sorts of audiences. And you've sort of done that with almost everything you've worked on. And just that fandom thing.
A Venn diagram of my retirement.
It's good. I like that. Where can we get those? do you miss going back to something that's very British, like with the league? I mean, when I spoke to Rhys, he said that you had talked about maybe doing something.
Yeah. No, we'd love to. No, I don't. I mean...
Do you feel like you've not been in that sort of world for a long time that it would be, or do you... In your head, it was like yesterday, and you could just...
Oh, yeah, well, it does feel like yesterday. Of course it does. It's years, but... And I'm constantly approached by people who say, I loved your show when I was a kid.
Oh, no.
It's frightening.
That is frightening.
Oh, thank you. What?
Yeah.
but it's not so much that. I mean, I don't got like getting your head turned or anything, because the Comic-Con sort of stuff with Sherlock or with Doctor Who... You have to disconnect yourself from it because it's mad. I mean, it's not in a pejorative way. It's extraordinary, the scale of something like San Diego. There's people dressed up and also, of course, people's demands on you. They start to demand things. So you have to shut that off because you go crazy.
Yeah, yeah.
But I think I still, you know, I used to do an awful lot of stuff for BBC Four, which I love doing. And I might be doing something for them next year. I hope so. And I do rather like that, just sort of doing something over here in a quieter way without either the weight of expectation or the scale, really.
Yeah.
You can just sort of do that.
Yeah.
That's nice.
It's the TV equivalent of putting on a play, I guess, in a way.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
It feels less
like this one that I'm doing now.
Yes. Which, by the way, when does that... You should plug it and say...
We open a week today on September the 28th. Mm-hmm. Till October the 30th, and then we go to Manchester, Lowry, Brighton Theatre Royal, and the West Yorkshire Playhouse in Leeds for a short 3-week tour.
And whilst you're doing that, you're going to be writing several series.
Christ knows. I don't know. I've been trying to catch up with my deadline. I just finished my new Doctor Who, though, so that's done.
Oh, good.
I'm very excited about that.
And is there anything that you're not very good at, like cooking?
Yes.
Is your personal life in tatters? Like something to make me feel better about?
No, I can't.
All the many things you're brilliant at.
I can't drive.
Okay.
I can't play a musical instrument. I can't speak any foreign languages. Like, this is really all I can do.
Suddenly I'm looking at you in a whole new light.
Really all I can do, and I'm so lucky because it's all I could do.
Yeah.
The only other thing I ever wanted to do was be a paleontologist, and I used to correspond with the Natural History Museum. I really thought about it because I was an avid fossil collector, but the A-levels were beyond me.
What did you study when you were at university?
I did drama degree.
Oh, okay. Because I was talking to Rich Fulcher the other week, and we were talking about how people go to, you know, expensive, prestigious colleges and study science or history, and then they decide to become a comedian.
Look at Ben Miller.
Yeah.
Ben Miller is like, we should probably be at NASA.
Yeah, and you think that's such a strange choice, isn't it?
But it's funny that, it's a funny thing, because you imagine, you very much put people into little things, you think, science, arts.
Yeah.
But there are people who are like Da Vinci, who just infuriatingly can do them both. And... you know, Ben's one of those. And also a curious thing amongst... I know several actors who were nearly professional footballers.
Yeah.
And you think, that doesn't seem right at all.
Yeah, yeah.
Jason Watkins, Michael Sheen, very nearly a footballer.
Really?
Really?
Yeah.
And imagine, he might now be playing international for are Wales and just doing funny impersonations in their changing rooms.
Yeah, yeah. Which would have been a good career as well. Would you? Are you like me where you just assume people in the arts or that did acting or comedy or were people that were no good at sports so they went there?
Like, but, and of course that is mostly true.
Yeah.
But then there are these extraordinary exceptions.
These exceptions. So, I was chatting to Reese and he said you guys might, you would like to get to. Have you talked more about that? I'm sure people
would
love
more.
It.
I mean, we've approached this period, which happens every 2 years, which makes the theatrical press always go a bit funny, as if there's some conspiracy where we're all doing plays at the same time. It genuinely happens every 2 years, and there is always something
this has
at
happened
the stage.
Before, so
it's happened three
really?
Times before. There's genuinely a headline at the stage saying, the League take over theatre. Like, no, we're just working. But they're always looking for an angle, and there isn't one.
It is. It is.
But we are meeting again towards the end of the year to have a chat about... it's over 10 years since the film, and we've never split up in that way, so we'd love to do something. I don't know what.
See, he revealed something to me that I never knew about you guys, which was that you often worked, writing-wise, in two pairs.
Yes.
And I never knew that. It's kind of like the Python
seamless
thing. Yeah. Because it all feels so,
oh,
it
that's
doesn't.
Good.
Yeah. And now that we know what their show with the two of them looks like, or two shows, in fact, what would a Jeremy and Mark show look like?
Oh, sadder, I think.
Would it?
I don't know. I think, I mean, I suppose.
I mean, there is a lot.
I suppose that's the stuff that kind of. It was that flavour which made it the League of Gentlemen, wasn't it? So the balance between the four of us. So, yes, I mean, our stuff was always.
I'm imagining, pathos. Because Jeremy doesn't perform, a show you two would make would be you wandering the plains of
being miserable. Well, I suppose, you know,
wistful looks into all
our,
the distance.
All our influences were, you know, Alan Bennett and Eric Chappell, great sitcom writers, great northern writers and actors. And so that's a very strong streak through us, is that... that kind of melancholy, really. And I think it's what people, amongst all the madness, I mean, that's something that we always used to love about doing the show, was that it had, it was sometimes extremely silly. People always bang on about it being dark. Some of it is so silly.
Yeah, yeah.
Just straightforward exploding dogs and fart jokes.
Yeah.
And some of it is so dark. I happened upon a bit of the Christmas special on UK Gold.
Yeah, that's also like the children saying, I loved your show. Being on Gold is the equivalent, isn't it?
I think we've always been there, not getting repeats. And I just thought, Jesus Christ, how did they allow us to let this out? It's so strange and very disturbing. The bit where Papa Lazarou kidnaps the young Bernice in that is like, it's like an assault.
Yeah. It feels like it would be harder, not impossible, but definitely harder to get that show.
Yeah, I mean, when we were talking about possible ideas about what to do, if we could come up with something, I said, why don't we do a mock documentary where we just sit and go through all our old stuff and just go, couldn't do that, and then just fade. That's all we've got left.
When did that happen? Because it felt like, you know, I was doing comedy at the same time, and it felt like we were talking about when it was hard to get stuff off the ground in the past. Now we're talking about when it was easy to get stuff.
I know. But see, that's the same. You don't realize you're living through a golden age as you're living through it.
Which is another reason why working in drama, not to like say that each thing is exclusively that, but it is a golden age in drama, definitely.
Yes, definitely.
Definitely. So
I don't know, when did it change? I mean, it's gradual, isn't it?
I think there was...
Some of it is depressingly familiar. The reliance on flavour of the monthness. I remember having a meeting about something just after Slumdog Millionaire had come out, and the entire meeting was dominated by the Slumdog effect. And you go, well, it's great, but this time next week you'll have another effect, which you'll want to warp this project into. Or, you know, when Miranda was a huge unexpected hit, everything was suddenly straight down the line, funny, pratfalls, you know, not a shred of darkness. And then you think, and I always think, well, but you're the same people sitting at home as us, and you want to watch a variety of different stuff.
Absolutely.
Not necessarily variety. Yeah. Although that's bad. But you know what I mean? It's like, but there's, you so often get that three-line whip thing of like, no, this is what people want now.
Yeah, yeah.
And until the moment someone does something different, James Holmes, you're stuck in that.
Yeah.
Amazing. The amazing James Holmes.
We're just sort of recognising each other in the middle of. I 100% agree. I had this. I was commissioned to write a sitcom for BBC One, and I foolishly thought, well, what you do is you sort of present it like a BBC One show, but you under the radar get some like slightly. I hate to go to this word always, but darker themes or edgier or. Slightly left field, and I'm talking just marginally. And the notes were, this was in the wake of the success of Mrs. Brown's Boys. This is verbatim. Could you make it a bit more like Mrs. Brown's Boys? I'm like, well, no, because I'm not the writer of Mrs. Brown's Boys. And that kind of following a hit and then making sort of pale imitations.
A poor version of it,
It
never goes away.
Yeah.
You can sort of understand the instinct to have, let's have some more of that.
Yeah.
But people aren't fooled. What they want is that.
Yeah.
And they'll wait until it comes back again. But if you try and, I mean, if you've got something which is a nice sort of hand in glove fit, you know, if they'd accidentally, here's a perfect example from years ago. Paul Jackson told me this years ago. They made The Young Ones, BBC had made The Young Ones because in a rare instance of being ahead of the curve, they were aware of Rick Mayall
and that
scene. And they didn't know what to do with it. And it was on a shelf and it was possibly in danger of never being shown. And then Channel 4 broadcast 5 Go Mad in Dorset. And it was on within minutes.
Wow.
And suddenly, and I remember it well, there was a moment. It's them again. And there's a series. Yeah, it's exactly what you want. Uh-huh. But it was an accident.
I love hearing the stories of the 70s, especially. Well, not those stories, by the way. But the commissioning stories where people like John Cleese would go into a commissioner's office and the commissioner would be like, I mean, I'm not sure I get it, but... Okay, go ahead and make it.
Oh, well, the famous one, I think it was Jimmy Gilbert, who commissioned Monty Python, and they were all in the office, and he said, is it a review? And they hadn't thought of it through. They just went, you know, are there any songs, girls, anything? Yeah. Nothing. It was going really badly, and he went, all right, but you can only have 13.
Oh, darn it. We were after 14. Well, look, it's been lovely talking to you. Good
pleasure.
Luck with the play and the deadlines. And a final plug. It's next Monday, right? 28th of September.
28th, next Wednesday we start.
Wednesday. Good luck.
On tour.
Yeah, good luck with the show.
Thanks.
Thank
Dan.
You.
Bless
for shaking
you.
Hands. No one can hear the handshake.
Do it make it very sweaty?
I know, my hand's quite sweaty. So thanks to Mark, what a great interview. I'm going to play us out with a piece of music that he'll be very familiar with but may not have heard in a while. I love this piece of music to their cult hit phenomenon, The League of Gentlemen. This is the opening titles. Thanks for joining.